Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with Wilbert Roget, and it's great to have a chance to talk again.
Hey, how's it going?
You just like never stop moving, which is so amazing. And your latest project is this epic soundtrack for Mortal Kombat 11, and oh my gosh, it is just a scorcher. I mean, was it as much fun to work on as it is to listen to?
You know, I never say this, but even while I was writing it, I was pretty sure that this is the most fun I've ever had working on a game score. I've worked on all this stuff that's like incredibly fulfilling, and you know, everything I work on seems to be quite difficult, but here it just already, just the context of it and the fact that I'd been a fan of this exact game for what, 25 years or something, just kind of all added up. That plus the people I'm working with and the way I got to score being so personal, I really loved this project. Yeah.
Oh, it really comes through. And I remember reading one of your tweets that you played this when you were just a kid, which is very cool. So what were some of the things that you remembered loving about it, about the series and the games when you were a kid that you wanted to, I don't know, just kind of bring back to write this music?
You know, it's funny. Like when I first played the game, it was classmates, you know, birthday party in middle school or something at the arcade. And I really wasn't into video games at the time. I was more just doing the music thing, and that was sort of my only entertainment, really, besides cartoons, I guess. And I just, you know, I was in this arcade, and I kind of beside myself. I didn't know what to do. And, you know, his dad handed me a bunch of quarters and said, you know, go nuts. And I just saw Mortal Kombat. It was one of the sort of premier arcade. You know how they have, like, they always structure the machine so that it's like, we really want you to play this one. So I checked it out, and I guess this is going to sound silly, but it was the realism. I mean, it just looked, I'd never seen anything that looked like that in a video game. At the time, video game just meant, oh, go to the right on this pixely thing and jump over stuff and maybe shoot some things.
Yeah, or they'd kind of cheat 3D and do like a wireframe kind of thing with a vanishing point.
Yep, it was that era where those games and the Pac-Man were kind of what I associated with it. But here we had not only a game that was quite realistic and quite human, and of course violent, which, you know, as any 12-year-old is like, yeah, you know, but it just felt like these were real characters, like something I would see in a movie. And then beyond that, they had such a focus, like a clear focus on story. You know, you really wanted to figure out, like, well, what's going on here? Like, who are these people? And why are they fighting? And what are all these different stages? And everything had so much lore behind it. You could clearly tell even just from the visuals. And soon after that, the first movie came out. And I saw that, and I was immediately hooked. It was one of my favorite films. Honestly, still is one of my favorite films of all time. And I know how campy it is and how silly, but it didn't matter because I was 12. and you know, even now I see it and I kind of appreciate it as, I'm pretty sure, still the best video game film adaptation that we've had yet.
And those are so hard to do. I'm actually partial to Angelina Jolie's Tomb Raider films because it brings back all the fun stuff that I loved about Tomb Raider. So I can totally see why you get into the movie, too, of Mortal Kombat. It's sort of like the world's longest cutscene, basically.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what were some of the suggestions that you got from the team right when you started working on the music?
You know, this is kind of interesting. The way that I got in contact with the team was I literally looked at my PlayStation game collection and I saw, oh, Mortal Kombat 10. Man, that game had great audio. I should, you know, talk to these people. And then I remember that one of the sound designers from Call of Duty World War II actually used to work at NetherRealm. So I asked for an introduction and he put me in touch with Rich Carl, the audio director. And Rich was like, yeah, you know, I actually remember you from your Lara Croft score and the GDC talk you did on it. So let's figure something out. And he gave me basically a music test for, you know, write the main theme for this game. And he gave me sort of like a PDF that talked about some of the story of Raiden versus Kronika and, you know, the time travel and all that. And once he sent that to me, a couple days later, we got on the phone And I gave him some ideas of what I was thinking. And he said, yeah, that's great. Go with that. Basically, he summed up the Mortal Kombat musical style as two things, aggression and the octatonic mode. And that was basically it. And this is a person, by the way, who he is a composer, actually. He worked on... Actually, I'm pretty sure he's been writing for every single Mortal Kombat game since, I want to say, Deception on the PlayStation 2.
Wow.
And Dan Forden, of course, is still there. He's been writing Mortal Kombat scores since the very beginning. And when you look at their musical influences, you see all of these composers like the, you know, Stravinsky, Shostakovich, and it sort of keeps coming back to these 20th century musicians who very much use the octatonic mode in their scoring, this sort of very dark, evil sounding harmonic language. And basically that was his main advice. It's like, do that and knock yourself out, just have fun with it.
Wow.
And I did, you know, the piece I did as a demo pretty much note for note is the main theme of the game. I only added one little synth line in the middle because I hadn't thought of a certain faction's leitmotif just yet. But that's the only change that I made. The rest, it's note for note. It's exactly what I did as a demo to get the gig in the first place.
That is so cool. And I was going to ask you about the motive that you've got running right through it. But first, let's like deconstruct the main theme, because you've got so much going on there with the Budapest Scoring Symphony Orchestra and then all those incredible soloists. So like right off the bat, did you know that you wanted to have this mix of a traditional orchestra with these incredible instruments?
I did know that Rich really gravitated towards one particular piece on my demo reel. It was called Cypress's Theme. It was for a film. And it used a lot of very kind of gritty synthesizer and orchestra in about equal amounts. And that's the, sort of the default sound that he gravitated towards. And I'm not sure where the world instruments aspect of it came in. I don't think it really had anything to do with MK11. I think that was just a Mortal Kombat thing. I mean, if you look back, especially to Mortal Kombat 2, which I would consider my primary inspiration, as well as the film, the first movie, they use all kinds of world instruments throughout, especially from East Asia. And I think with MK11, I saw Kronika, who's the main villain, and she has this hourglass motif about her whenever she's like teleporting in to do whatever. She always appears in like a haze of sand. And I just figured, okay, well, we can do something with this. Why don't we have some Middle Eastern instruments to represent her and then East Asian instruments to represent Raiden? And it kind of snowballed from there. At first, it was like, okay, well, we have these. And then I have the Comanche player that I had hired on Lara Croft in the Temple of Osiris. I had befriended a former student at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, Chan-Chan Jin, and she plays the guzheng. And so I hired her for that. And then I brought in Doug Perry, who's a percussionist, and he's playing mostly kind of North African and Middle Eastern percussion instruments. And it kind of went from there. Once the main theme was completed and I went on to the main score, more and more characters got introduced, and eventually I realized two things. Number one, this has to be a leitmotif character-based score. That was the only way to unite everything, but also give it enough diversity so that it's a compelling soundtrack as a whole. But two, I needed a lot more than just Middle East and East Asia. I need to go quite literally to all four corners of the world to find enough instruments and sound sources so that every single character could have their own signature sound. And hopefully it's to the point where you can listen to a piece of music without the visuals, but you just hear all these different sounds and you can say, okay, well, this synthesizer is here, so it must be Kano, and this Kulning is here, so it must be Cetrion, and so on.
One of the things that I picked up on right away was that very, very tiny motif that pops up in a lot of the tracks. And where did that one come from?
That was kind of the uniting motive of the score. I call it the theme of Mortal Kombat. And then subtitle, I call it the theme of solving all your problems with violence. Because that's basically, if you look at where it's used, that's basically where it comes in, where at times when it's like, we could have easily just talked this through, but Mortal Kombat, you know, so here we are.
Fight.
But it was quite useful because, again, it kind of outlines the octatonic mode and it sort of fits wherever. It's in an interesting twist, it's actually used in kind of a 20th century set theory kind of way. So it's not just melodic, but it's also used as a basis for harmony. There's times when I'll just take those three notes, the bum, 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 ba-da-dum, and then I'll just kind of layer them as a chord. And any time where I just needed some quick reminder that, hey, we're in this universe and this is what the rules are, basically, I would use that chordally. as a harmonic gesture. And so that's kind of how it's used throughout. It was a great way to sort of unite all the different kind of sonic worlds that we had to that I had to create for all these different characters. As far as how I came up with it, you know, whenever I write themes, it's just pages and pages of iteration and bad ideas leading to like meh ideas leading to okay, let's good enough to, you know, write a score based off of this kind of ideas, and eventually, yeah, that was the result.
Well, what's so cool about it is that it's so very simple that it can be like a real chameleon too, I would think. And so you can make a lot of iterations of it, like you said, as it's needed for all the different tracks. So have you found over the years that the little motives or themes that are the simplest are usually the easiest to work with?
In a way, yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that I learned from the Call of Duty World War II score. The way I grew up with game music was mostly with Japanese game scores, which tends to use much more thematic melodies, very elaborate and almost song-like, with verses and choruses and whatnot. But more and more as I go along, I've kind of moved away from that and towards this much more motivic, simple gestures, because those you can weave into a lot more different circumstances. And they're much more malleable. And so that I have gravitated towards that quite a bit ever since Call of Duty, I would say.
One of the cues that just really got to me, because I've been listening in the car a lot, is Timequake. And that one, oh my gosh, I thought it was going to blow my car doors open. It's just so intense.
Yeah, you know, the Timequake scene, which is at the very beginning where Kronika has now folded time in on itself so that, you know, some characters are meeting past versions of themselves and existing in the same timeline because they've been moved forward. That was a lot of fun to write because we actually worked on that scene much later due to the realities of production with the cinematic team. And so I had already written a bunch of the leitmotifs for the characters. And so when each character is being introduced one by one in that scene, I'm able to reference them. So it's almost like as they walk out of the sand time teleport thing, you see just a little bit of each character. You know, I think there's 8 characters or 9 maybe in that scene, which is a lot of fun to coordinate. It was almost like a table of contents for, you know, what you're about to experience for the rest of the game.
we haven't talked about yet with your tracks is all the synth sounds that you incorporated too. And so with so many different colors, you know, millions of colors to play with synths, how did you finally like narrow them down and zero in on what was going to be the best synth sound?
Oh yeah. Well, that actually is an easy one. I have four different, actually a little more than that now, but I have a couple of hardware analog synthesizers. It's something that I got into during and especially after working on Destiny 2, Forsaken. And the way that I use these is that each individual instrument is connected to a faction or a character. So, for example, I have a Moog subfatty, which is a very classic and warm sound that you would expect from a Moog synth. And I use that for the Special Forces faction whenever they're doing action or suspense. So this is Johnny Cage, Cassie, Sonya, Jackie, and to some extent Jax. And it's very clean and it's high tech, but responsibly so, let's say. It's got the kind of sound that you would expect from like the Hans Zimmer sort of Harry Gregson Williams type world. But then I have synths like the Arturia Mini Brute 2. It's semi-modular, which means that I can do a lot of weird, mad scientist type stuff with it and make it sound just very on edge, like it's just close to fizzling out. I mean, I can really make this thing sound like I accidentally poured water on a synthesizer and then all hell broke loose. And so I use this. I use this for the Black Dragon faction with Kano and Cabal. And the reason why is you look at Kano and here's someone who, first off, is a horrible human being in the best way possible. And he has used technology in an irresponsible way. He's, you know, he's lost his eye, so he's replaced that with an eye laser, and he's got all of these crazy stuff that he's has going on. So he's a different kind of high tech. So I have various leads and arps and whatnot from each of these instruments to represent those characters. And lastly, I have the Korg MS-20 Mini, which is very well known for its low-pass filter. It's got the growliest, nastiest low-pass filter of anything I have ever heard. It is so vicious and biting, and I decided that that should be the theme for the Revenant faction. And the Revenants are these Netherrealm, not copies, but like characters who have, let's say, died in the real world, have been resurrected in the Netherrealm, and they're angry and seeking revenge on Raiden for causing their deaths. And so, yeah, the Netherrealm faction is just this, it's just this descending chromatic line on the MS-20 with just this growling wah filter going on.
Wow.
And that's basically how it works. I mean, each one kind of has its very specific purpose. I pretty much didn't touch the settings on any of these synths. I just kind of saved out a couple, maybe two patches max for each of these. And, well, maybe not save, but you know what I mean? Like, they're analog, so you can't really save anything. So, I just kind of kept them alone and didn't touch anything. And people come over, hey, stay away from these synths because this is my life right now. And kept it as is. And that's all they did for the 6 months or however when I was writing the score.
Oh, man. I mean, that's sort of like just having an instrument right there, right? You know, like a violin or something. It's just, once you get the settings, it just kind of pick it up and start playing. So that's very cool. That made me wonder about your studio setup and whether you're able to listen to things as epically loud as I was in the car, or if you have to like worry about neighbors.
You know, funny enough, I only write on headphones. It's kind of weird. I used to, when I was at Lucas, I was one of those people who swore by, like, you need proper studio monitors, you need all this, you know, and I had amazing Meyer sound, you know, about $10,000 worth of speakers or something, and treated room and all that. But now that I'm obviously writing full-time, I kind of just prefer headphones. It's just the way I do it. I like to kind of divorce myself from the reality around me and just kind of go into a creative space. And I just find it so much harder to do that with speakers because you're always going to hear the real world around you. Whereas with headphones, and I use open air ones, so I guess you still hear quite a bit of the real world, but I still feel like I'm able to kind of transport myself into the mix and see exactly what's going on and make decisions based on that.
I'm sure it helps to stay focused, to just be listening with headphones. So.
It really does, yeah. I much prefer it. Plus, I'm very bashful, and I can't stand when people hear unfinished things of mine. I mean, obviously, once it's finished, then I'm blasting this out to the entire world. But when it's not, I'm too shy to let anyone hear anything that's not completely signed off upon.
Yeah. Well, another element of the score that we haven't really talked about is the chorus, because, man, they really get a workout. Is that an actual chorus, or did you use samples for that?
It's kind of both. There's a lot that is, you know, sample-based, but a surprising lot of the men's choir is actually me just kind of layering myself, especially when there's lyrics or anything like that that is significant. Yeah, there's definitely a good bit of Latin in there and just generic oohs and ahs kind of stuff.
Wow, do you speak Latin?
I studied in middle school and ninth grade. I used to be really surprisingly good at Latin. It's quite a story, but for whatever reason, I switched to French eventually because I was tired of it taking 10 minutes just to figure out how to say one sentence, you know.
Well, what's so cool about Latin is that it has this weight of history, and so it sounds really important and very powerful, like some kind of incantation, even if you don't really know what the words are and what the people are singing.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, in fact, I'll give you one hint. There is a piece called Netherrealm Incursion early in the soundtrack, and Shinnok, who is the evil elder god, let's say, originally, I thought he would have a bigger part in the story, so I wrote him a brief theme, but his theme is actually just the Latin translation of one of his victory quotes from Mortal Kombat 10, I guess. Mors vocatae.
mean, I've heard from a few composers that writing for chorus is completely different from writing for instruments. And have you found that too?
It is, and I love it. You know, I've sang in so many different choirs growing up and even recently. It's a different form of orchestration, really. I always encourage composers to sing, even if they don't have... I mean, I have composer voice, too. It's okay, you know. Composer voice meaning, yeah, you can kind of get the notes, but it's not anything that anyone wants to listen to. But it's a great way to study melodic writing, and especially with regards to chorus. There's so many great composers out there that have done fantastic choral arrangements, and it's different from writing for a string section or a brass section or whatever. So it's good to kind of have firsthand experience with that.
Yeah.
In addition to chorus, I mean, I also wrote a lot for solo vocals in this score, which was a real treat to be able to do that, especially working with Laura Intravia and Emma Sundring.
Oh, sure.
They were the vocalists on this score, and they just unbelievable talents. Laura's vocalizations were mostly used for the Shaolin, and Emma... She's an interesting character. So she sings in a style called Kulning, which originates from Scandinavia. And it's not really meant for the concert hall. It's actually almost like a form of yodeling used to call cows from great distances in the forest. This is actually the, you know, what that is. It's that sound. And I needed a sound for Cetrion, who's an elder goddess. She's sort of the paragon of virtue. And I just figured, you know what, this would be perfect. She has this ice queen kind of motif. She's got all of these different nature vibes. And her job is basically to shepherd humanity into doing the right thing. So it just sort of luck of the draw. I mean, I just liked the sound, but then it turned out that this is the perfect analog for Cetrion. So I found her via the composer from... Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons, which is another absolutely fantastic score that I loved so much. And she was the soloist from that. And he directed me to her, and she sang especially towards the final act of the game, is when her solos come in.
That is just so cool. Well, with all of these soloists and then and the singers, how much direction did you give them, or did you just kind of turn them loose and let them do what they do best with improvising or coming up with a really unique and different sound?
Yeah, I usually will give just the score and have them go at it. I usually don't believe too much in having musicians that are recording remotely do a bunch of revisions, part because it takes all of us a ton of time. Maybe they have to set things up again and it won't be exactly the same as before or anything like that. And part because there's a lot you can do when you're working with a soloist to edit. So if something is, oh, maybe just a little bit earlier or later, whatever, then I can just handle that as the waveform. So I don't really do too much with revisions or direction. I usually just try to make the scores as clear as possible. Or in cases where there is no score, I'll try to do as good of a mock-up as I can that just illustrates exactly how I want it. You may have noticed that I kind of tend to work with the same people over and over again. And by now, we kind of have a mutual understanding of how things work.
Yeah. And the whole effect is just so unified. And one of the things that has come up a few times with other composers working with world instruments is that, you know, they can only play in one key, or they're kind of limited. So did you have to write the orchestral parts kind of around them and around whatever the limitations are of these instruments?
The only time that came up was with the guzheng and the duduk. But in both cases, it wasn't too big of an issue. With the guzheng, Changchun was able to just tune it to the piece. And I gave her the piece, and we just kind of talked a little bit before she was recording. And she looked it through, and she said, yep, no problem. And she just banged it out, and it was perfect, really. And then she did a bunch of improvisations. With the duduk, it's a little bit more limited, but Herman, he has this... He can kind of make it work, because he's also a film composer, actually. And he's learned to play in such a way that he can kind of just make it work with different fingerings, I guess, and almost kind of pitch bending in order to get it to fit into whatever key that I go into. So, I mean, that plus a little bit of, you know, like auto-tune or whatever, and it usually just works out.
Yeah, well, and that's the beauty of working with really professionals too, is that they can work with you, and so it ends up dovetailing really nicely. So
absolutely, yeah.
There was one cue we sort of touched on Kronika a little bit, and how she has an hourglass. And there's one track that I really stood out to me because the beginning of it has a really different feel than many of these other sort of aggressive, ruthless sounding tracks. And the hourglass has this beautiful kind of shimmering strings. And the first thing I thought of when I heard it was Arvo Pärt's Tabula Rasa, because of the way he uses strings. And so I don't know if that was an influence, but that's what I heard. And so I wondered if there were other composers that you kind of looked toward to, you know, for inspiration for this.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't thought about that, but I actually am quite familiar with Tabula Rasa. It's a gorgeous piece of music. And in this case, the way that piece worked was, so Matthias Souza was our violinist for that, violin soloist. And I wrote, let's say, 2.5 measures of music, mostly kind of arpeggios, but with a sort of random kind of soupy rhythm to it and just sort of floating around, and allowing him to do his signature very romantic vibrato. And after that, it goes into like an aleatoric cell where I just list a bunch of pitches and I just direct him to improvise arpeggios through all of those pitches. And so it's three of those, you know, two violins and one viola. And I just have him do that improvisation for about 30 seconds each. And that's sort of the backbone of the piece. I just layered those, and then there's some effects like delays and whatnot. But essentially, that's the whole thing. And then after that, I layered in the orchestra and choir. It's a technique, actually, that I've heard in the pieces of Ludoslawski.
Oh, yeah.
His second symphony in particular, where it's just, here's this jumble of pitches, you know, play these at whatever rhythm. But they're tonal. It's not really random. It's more, I guess, chaotic. Is that the better term? And it's a technique, actually, that I use quite a bit on Call of Duty World War II. But here, instead of doing it on brass to give this vague memory of war vibe, but here it was more just a textural element. In this case, it's the hourglass, and that's a moment where time is rewinding itself. And to me, that sounded like, you know, that classic sound, which I guess younger people now might not know of, where you're taking the tape cassette and rewinding and it's kind of still playing. So it's that, you know, the kind of thing. And that's sort of where that comes from. But it also, it's kind of a heartbreaking moment in the story as well. So that's where the romantic vibrato and expression comes in. So just sort of the combination of those two things. is what led to this piece.
It's such a gorgeous sound, and it really stands out because it's so different from a lot of the other tracks. You had such a wonderful opportunity, kind of a golden opportunity, really, to score the cutscenes in the games. So besides this one, The Hourglass, are there any others that like were really standouts for you and that you're especially proud of?
Yeah, I mean, the cinematic team did such an amazing job on this game. I mean, it's obviously, you know, quite campy. It's in that Mortal Kombat style. And I think they did such a great job of getting that perfect sort of 90s action vibe. And that's what allowed me to write such, you know, kind of quote unquote big music. You know, it's an extroverted orchestration style that's not quite as fashionable anymore. So I did kind of have to dip into those 90s and 80s film score influences more than I normally would be able to. But I really loved being able to work on that. And there's some great scenes in the film. I mean, I'm sorry, in the game. That's how elaborate these cutscenes are. It felt like a movie almost. It felt like two movies. Like, my job is to score the movie and its sequel at the same time. I would say towards the end of the game, almost everything in the final act is just way over the top epic. All the gloves come off. But the moment that really launches us into the final act is this moment of realization where Raiden finally understands that he's kind of been stuck in, I don't want to say a time loop, but just more like multiple timelines. And in each of those timelines, a bad thing happens. And he finally realizes the pattern. And in this scene, the cinematic is actually going through moments where a certain fight happens in every single Mortal Kombat game. And it's finally bringing together all the times that the series has rebooted. So there's stuff in there from Mortal Kombat 9. There's stuff in there from the PS2 games, from Mortal Kombat Armageddon. And it's showing all of these. So it's almost like a love letter to the fans that have been with the Mortal Kombat franchise since forever, showing them all of this just rapid fire. The piece is called Anagnorisis, and it's where I got to use the church organ, probably for the first time in my career that I've ever. It doesn't really come up all that often, but It's just these church organ pulses later on matched with choir staccatos. What I'm trying to do currently is figure out the simplest way to convey things that I see on screen. And here it's literally just quarter notes for about 2 minutes, just single chord quarter notes on the organ and the choir. But it just matched very well with the vibe of the scene. And it's all this chaotic action, but the music is so simple as he's realizing exactly what's going on.
It's an amazing point in the game, and to have that kind of music, yeah, sort of is something to hold on to while all this stuff is happening on the screen. It's just, wow, it's really powerful.
Yeah, I saw the scene, and, you know, we were spotting with Rich Carl and Marty Soltz. Marty Soltz is the cinematic director, and I saw it, and I was like, man, I have so much music left to write, and this is going to be so hard. There's all these quick cuts, and oh, man, what am I going to do? But then I kind of sat down with it, you know, I had my paper out, and I just thought, wait, why do I have to, I don't have to follow this scene at all. It's all a memory, and it's all in his mind. And so that's where that organ thing came in, because it's almost like the, you know, ticking clock, you know, it's like one per second of him realizing all this stuff going on, and all it is just growing and growing with these chords. So yeah, it was very fortuitous, because it didn't take very long to write, but it worked for the scene, and that's kind of what counts, is the simplicity.
Yeah, for sure, and that's the main thing anyway. I mean, altogether, how long did you have to write this soundtrack?
It's funny, I wrote the main theme, I think, I'd have to look it up, but it's much earlier than you would think, because again, it was just like a demo, but we started from chapter one and just more or less went linearly through to chapter 12. And I think the first cutscene was finished in late July, early August. And then the very final stuff was, I want to say the beginning of February, or maybe the end of June, or January, something like that. So however many months, in my mind, that's about 6 months maybe, or?
Yeah, 6 or 7.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, it's about a 2.5 hour score.
Wow. Well, with such a huge project like this, I mean, how do you manage it? Because you've probably got other things going on simultaneously, but how do you manage a project like this to make sure that you're delivering everything on time and it's up to the standards that you've set for yourself and the standards that you know the studio's expecting?
You know, honestly, Rich was he was the one who made this happen by scaring me half to death every freaking week. Like, so he'd have these graphs. I was so mad at first, but then I'm like, no, he really needed to do this. He would have these graphs that were basically like, okay, so here's where we're at, and here's where we need to be. And I was so terrified every time. But yeah, you're right. You know, I was working on Star Wars Vader Immortal, the VR experience, at exactly the same time. In fact, they had the same day deadline, which was crazy. That was a hell of a weekend, that final. Yeah, but yeah, you know, it was mostly Rich being the voice of reason and saying, hey, you know, just as quickly as possible, let's make sure that we get this done. I mean, from my end, it was tricky because, I mean, it was a score that I absolutely loved writing. And there were times when I just knew I had to spend a little bit of extra time on this. I guess to answer your question, the real trick was I just knew up front that developing themes for the characters would take time. Figuring out leitmotifs and, in many cases, just doing all of the synth sound design, that just took a long time. But once I kind of had the sounds and I sort of knew how to get there, then it went much more autopilot. It was much easier to get through it. But the cutscenes, they just took longer at the beginning than they did at the end. And I pretty much just told Rich, hey, this is probably how it's going to go. And he was totally on board with that. Still scared me half to death like 90% of the time. But nonetheless, we kept on track and, you know, delivered everything on time and everything. So it all worked out.
Yeah, well, and not only did it just work out, but it's the whole effect, the whole finished project, the package is just this phenomenally cohesive, really epic soundtrack. So as hard as it might have been, I mean, the end result is really spectacular.
Oh, thank you so much.
We've covered a lot, but is there anything else that that I didn't touch on that you think is really important or that you especially enjoyed about the whole process of writing the soundtrack?
Yeah, I think that my two favorite things about working on this score were the collaborations with all these musicians. I mean, first off, you see the credits list of all the soloists, and that's just the soloists I wasn't able to list like the whole orchestra. I wish I could have, but that just info wasn't available. But I mean, I worked with so many people one-on-one that some knew, some that I'd never worked with, and they were amazing, like Emma. And others that I'd known or worked with for years and years, and we kind of have an understanding, and it was just great to come together on this project. And the other part is that even the characters themselves in the game, I mean, they're not real, they're just made up characters, but, you know, you got to think, I've lived with these characters for 20 years. I mean, I remember in my eighth grade wood shop and clay class or whatever, art class, I made like a bust of Sub-Zero because I was such a fanboy, and I found some way. The only way, they didn't, the stipulation was you weren't allowed to make characters from video games or like cartoons or anything. And I only got away with it because Sub-Zero was always played by like a human being. It's like a person, right? Because it was the digitized actor, so they let me do it. And I was like, yeah, no one else had thought of this, you know. And I mean, I've been such a little fanboy of this series since forever that it all came together really nicely. And it felt like an unreal privilege being able to go to all these different characters that I'd known, again, for 20, 25 years, and then some new characters, and give them a voice. I don't think the series has really ever had specific character themes in the games themselves. And so, again, it's an amazing privilege to be able to create that voice. And then last but not least, you know, I'm starting to get more and more active on Twitter. And I got to say that the Mortal Kombat fan community is a joy to behold. I mean, it feels like a family, honestly. Family of thousands of people. I mean, they have a whole thing, the Mortal Kombat creators, I forget exactly what it's called, but it's just all the artists and sculptors and cosplayers who've dedicated so much time to the craft. And they're not employees or anything. They just love the game and they're showing their fandom through their talents. Between them and the competitive scene players, it feels like just this huge Mortal Kombat family that, you know, finally I've had the privilege of contributing to. And, you know, just seeing their reactions on Twitter and on YouTube and seeing how much joy this game has brought them, it's really been an amazing experience. And then, of course, I can't not mention the team themselves at NetherRealm. Just an astronomical amount of talent that's been put into this game and really everything they do. You see just some of the best art that we've, like, ever seen in games has gone into this. I don't think I've ever seen anything that's this compelling visually. And I love what they've done with the story as well. This is exactly my personal favorite balance of of campiness versus seriousness. You know, you have the two extremes. You have, like, Mario, and then you have maybe, like, Last of Us or something. And it's right in the middle. And that's where I love being. I really love that we're able to do a diverse and polychromatic, let's call it, score for this one. I mean, I had a lot of fun on Call of Duty World War II. I would consider that a very monochromatic score in that we figured out one very precise music direction and went with that through the whole thing. Whereas here, I also really enjoy working with lots of different sounds and embracing that diversity in how I write. I like to not limit myself to one thing, but be able to experiment with lots of different combinations of things and combinations of genres. And this, in a way, was just the perfect game to do that.
Right at the very end of the game, there's, well, I wouldn't say it's out of character exactly, but the end credits theme is just really, really great to listen to. And so how did that collaboration come about?
Yeah, you know, we were trying so hard to make this feel like a classic 90s film. And I thought to myself, well, normally what they do is they just, you know, end credits roll and they go into like a playlist of some music from the game. And, you know, that's sort of it. But I wanted to do something special because again, it's all for the fans and they've just gone through this maybe 3-4 hour long storyline. We wanted it to seem special once the credits rolled so that they stick around. And so the thought occurred to me, like, well, why not do just an actual song? Why not do something, maybe collaborate with someone? And I hit up a friend of mine who also lives in Seattle right now, Luke Alex Esquivel. He's an amazing EDM producer. He's the producer of an EDM group called Super Square. And I said, hey, you know, like all the performers and collaborators, I couldn't even tell him what exactly the game was. But I said, hey, are you interested in working with me on like an EDM track for something? And he's like, yeah, sure. And I got him the NDA and I told him, okay, cool. So it's Mortal Kombat, first of all. Secondly, the reason, besides the fact that he's just an incredible electronic producer, he's also a former competitive fighting game player, just a wizard at Street Fighter. He's, you know, winning tournaments and stuff. I mean, he's well known too. It's one of those people that just kind of everyone knows. And so it just seemed like one of the most obvious decisions that I had to make. So I brought him over and I showed him a bunch of the different themes from the game, and we kind of decided on using Kitana's theme, which is the sort of rising stepwise thing that comes in especially towards her chapter. And we also used Fire God Liu Kang theme, which is this descending sort of motif, also scale-wise. And lastly, Raiden's theme, which is mostly about the fifths and kind of has this heroic vibe to it. And we kind of worked out exactly how those would come together. We sort of arranged the song form and how that would do. And he just went off on his own and produced this awesome piece that we put into the game. And then for the album, we had the idea of why don't we expand this to like a full track? And so we brought in Mega Ran, Rahim Jabra, and he's a very well-known sort of nerdcore rapper. I don't know if they like that term, by the way, but that's just how, you know, he's known. And he's the main vocalist for that. Helen Nowick, who's the singer from Super Square, laid some vocals in the chorus, and then Alex himself raps in the second verse. And yeah, that all kind of just came together. I'm so happy that we were able to produce this track and put it into the game because it feels final to me. I don't know, something about how it was arranged and how Alex produced the track, it feels like a perfect kind of bookend to this very busy, epic, and fantasy score. And that's what I really loved about working with him, is that, you know, he really gets it. You know, he's been also a Mortal Kombat fan since forever. Same with Mega Ran. And just getting fans together and doing something that actually contributes to the franchise is what I loved so much about this project.
Yeah, wow. Well, that joy and that enthusiasm just really, really shines through. And Will, it's been so much fun talking with you about it. So thank you so much for taking some time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, make it grand. Ready for combat. At the helm, never break, and I never bend. Nether realm, give and take, never let them win. Never ran, never will, this is in my skin. In my blood, for the love, this will never end. 11 years, lost peers, I can recommend. When death's knocking at the door, never let them in. Through the breaks, through the bruises, and through the cracks. Do your worst, do the work, swear I'm coming back. Through the dirt, universe bow when I spit a rap. Fatality on every track, it's a wrap. Anytime, any space, stay ready for any attack. Pull a spine through a back, hit a snap, it's a fact. I've been ready for war, that's the fitness of the day I was born. Set to perform, I never let a competitor score. Bring on the gore, I'ma get mine, you better get yours. Like never before, you come in that meeting, you better be sure. This is Mortal Kombat. We take it to the limit, then we go beyond that. This is Mortal Kombat. We take it to the limit, then we go beyond that.
Yeah. Who next? Who next? Sharp like an ice pick in the game. Y'all wanna die quick in the game. Y'all get a spine rip in the flame, doing splits. Call me Cage with the glitz and the fame. Bringing the pain, fighting y'all noobs just isn't the same. Cause I got that call loo and a crew with a can. Come food to the brain and take them out with a bang.
Yeah.
Ha, ain't nothing changed. Earth is a little bit strange with a new coat of paint. But even if your arms got blades, I reckon everyone up in your body on stage. I'm a warrior and you can never stop me. Even Shang and Seven never try to copy. Disconnect the haters, leave them in the lobby. Y'all can back and pop me.
This is Mortal Kombat. We take it to the limit, then we go beyond that. This is Mortal Kombat. We take it to the limit, then we go beyond that. You can't empower the powerless when you down with the cowardice. And these clowns on the power trip, and there ain't no way out of this now. This is Mortal Kombat. We take it to the limit, then we go beyond that. This is Mortal Kombat. We take it to the limit, then we go beyond that. This is Mortal Kombat. We take it to the limit, then we go beyond that.